of the Center for Bioethics and Health Law at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. And she has just a fascinating subject to talk about, one which is very much rooted in science and ethics, but which very much touches it intersects with issues of faith in really some obvious and some surprising ways. So thank you so much. We are honored to have you with us, and I appreciate this fascinating subject that you're taking on for us.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I will mutter along while I begin to share my screen. There we are. And there we are. And when we scheduled this many years ago, it feels, but then had chose to delay for a bit and so on, I had no idea that this would be a day that some people are paying particular attention to family relationships. Although I'll be talking about daddies, paternity in particular, we'll nod in the direction as well of the ways that our technology can raise questions about our relationships with mothers as well. And my adopted dog has just come in. So I would like, therefore, to talk about our ancestry, our forefathers. I'll begin by reminding us about the different types or uses of genomic testing. Today we'll focus in particular on diagnostic testing and the resolution of a diagnostic odyssey, of attempting to figure out what in the world is wrong with this daughter, this girl who is suffering from an undiagnosed condition. Also touch on pharmacogenomic testing and mention tumor testing to guide treatment or its use in research. Then next week, we'll talk more about predictive testing for susceptibility to disease. So I really want to talk about fathers and forefathers today to be able to raise considerations about two different sets of ethical issues related to genetic testing. And the first is incidental findings, the things that we used to say were unexpected that you could discover when doing genetic testing. But we now, as ethicists, really urge researchers and clinicians to say, look, you should be anticipating these now. They are to be expected. So we have evolved a somewhat different definition of understanding incidental findings. And as we'll discuss, they're anything but incidental to the people about whom they apply, to whom they apply. Then I also want to talk about the relevance of ancestry for interpreting results. This is a bit more of a scientific issue, but it has ethical implications. So I want to begin with a pediatric case, kind of a composite. Any of the photos I use would be used with permission. So imagine that a mother comes to Children's Hospital to meet with specialists in neurology because her young daughter has seizures. No one has been able to find the reason, the cause for her daughter's seizures, and sometimes she has as many as 50 a week. And as we know, having multiple seizures does affect brain development, and so there's great reason for concern. She comes to Children's Hospital for an evaluation of her daughter's condition, and she's offered genomic sequencing in the hope of understanding whether there's a genetic contribution to her daughter's seizure disorder, and then in turn, how that information might guide the treatment of the disorder. The mother had heard that epilepsy runs in families, so she knew that this might be relevant. She knew also that her sister is planning to start a family. So mom wondered whether she would learn anything from sequencing that might be relevant to her sister's future children. And then she wondered out loud to the genetic counselor with whom she was meeting about how her husband might respond, because he'd not talked to his brother for the past 5 years. They'd had a major falling out. So if there was a genetic component on her husband's side, then there'd be the question of what to do with that information, and that could be very difficult to handle. And further, because she and her husband were planning to start their own small business, she worried about how he and they together would handle more stress beyond the business concerns and their daughter's current health issues. So there's the possibility also of learning other genetic information, not relevant to her daughter's seizures, but perhaps relevant to other aspects of her daughter's health or her own or her husband's health. Would she want to be informed of these so-called incidental findings, these sequencing results that are not related to the reason for testing, but that have potential health significance? So that's how we've developed a new definition, or a more precise definition, of what an incidental finding of testing is. It's a result of finding that concerns a particular person, and in genetics, by extension, perhaps a family, that's discovered in the course of clinical testing or in the context of research that has potential health or reproductive importance, but is unrelated to the reason for testing. And in this case, for example, we could ask about health information not related to the current condition. So we can ask whether those incidental findings should be reported into the daughter's medical record. What if, for example, a BRCA mutation, a breast cancer related mutation, were discovered in the daughter's genome, but she's, what, 3, 4? We would not usually recommend testing for an adult onset cancer in someone so young. We think that's her right and opportunity to make that decision when she reaches the age of majority. But it could be discovered now. If, as a physician, I were to receive, and I'm not a physician, by the way, but if I were a physician and if I received that kind of information, I would feel duty bound to put it into the daughter's health record. Maybe for ethical reasons, but certainly for legal reasons. I wouldn't want someone to say that I had failed to provide into the record information that might be useful for her future health. Now, of course, if there were a BRCA mutation, breast cancer related mutation in daughter's genome, that would suggest that there is a similar mutation perhaps in either the father or the mother. And so that raises questions about telling them and about their then being tested. Our mom might quite reasonably say that she has too much on her mind right now to engage in more breast cancer surveillance, more frequent mammography right now, breast screening. She might realize that to get a small business loan, she and her husband need to take out life insurance. So although for health insurance, the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act prohibits health insurers or employers from using genetic information to deny coverage, disability, life insurance, long-term care insurance, auto insurers, all of those folks, those companies, can still make use of genetic information. So we have questions about the daughter's right to future privacy when she reaches a time when she has actual privacy interests that we think, you know, apply only to children as they begin to mature and to adults. And there are questions then also about whether mom would say, I have a right not to know what's going on with regard to anything but my daughter's seizures. Tell me only that information. Or does she have to accept that that's a concomitant opportunity or risk of having genomic sequencing in her daughter, that she might learn information she's not really prepared to deal with right now. She might also worry that she has too much on her mind and that she doesn't want to deal with the possibility that genomic testing sequencing could reveal that her husband is in fact not her daughter's genetic father. So this misattributed paternity or a misattributed genetic relationship is the kind of incidental finding that since the very beginning of contemporary genetics, we've realized can be discovered. It can reveal an affair, it can reveal a rape, and we could hypothesize that that's the last thing that this mother thinks her family could cope with at this time. Moreover, perhaps as the genetic counselor continues to discuss this possibility of sequencing with mom, and what we're specifically looking for in the daughter's genome, we also have to, the genetic counselor also has to explain that even if they don't discover anything, no incidental findings in the daughter's genome, that doesn't mean that the daughter or mom or dad have a clean bill of health, that there are no genetic findings to discover. There may still be relevant information there, but it's just not being looked for or interpreted this time. It could turn up, but it's not necessarily going to, but it could still be there to have health effects in the future. So that was one aspect of today's title, at least, talking about fathers. And I guess I should perhaps go back if I can and say, because I was going to also say something about just misattributed genetic relationships more generally, that you can, on genetic testing or genomic sequencing, discover in some people, or people can discover, that, mom actually had an egg donor. Or there are other than misattributed relationships, misunderstood or undisclosed relationships in the family. Maybe someone was adopted. There was an egg donor or a sperm donor, and that hasn't been disclosed to an individual as yet. So questions about what's appropriate to share about adoption and donations in reproductive contexts is evolving as our science evolves, and it becomes more likely that people will discover and thus have questions, will discover the truth, then have questions about whether they should trust their parents or trust the medical system that hasn't told them something previously that they feel they had a right to know. So genetics opens up the whole world of finding genetically related relatives. And it will soon be the case, I think, that for people at least of a particular economic level, fairly wealthy, able to pay $150 or more for genetic testing. And not only the money to pay, but the time and the kind of bandwidth to care. There are a lot of people who, if they're struggling economically, if they're dealing with other issues in their lives, if they're dealing with racism on a daily basis, worrying about their genetics may be the last thing on their plate, on their minds. But for people of a particular social situation, the world is indeed opening up to discover relatedness in ways not previously understood. So one of the things that a person can do, as we mentioned last time, is go to a direct-to-consumer genetic testing company like 23andMe, Ancestry.com, and others, and have one's ancestry genes characterized. And then further, you can register your genetics, your genetic composition, and your actual genetic findings. And then you can open yourself up and others can seek potential genetic matches of actual familial relationships. So not just other Swedish people, other people who have Irish background, for example, but people who are actually in the O'Malley family that's right here in Pittsburgh. So if you pay for this health and ancestry service, you learn information not only about the continental ancestry of yourself and your family, but also have the opportunity to learn a range of information about carrier status, disease susceptibility, and various traits like tasting cilantro as being pleasant or not. So I want to discuss another case, Mr. Gordon, and that we'll use him, a fictional character in this case, to look at some of the issues associated not only with doing ancestry testing like this, but the relevance of one's continental background for interpreting health-related traits. So Mr. Gordon is a 55-year-old African-American man who was persuaded by his wife to go to see his doctor because he's increasingly depressed since his sister died of cancer 3 years ago. This has moved beyond the blues. It's persistent. We might say that he has complex grief, but it's really affecting his life. He wants to stop feeling sad and hopeless. And so he accedes to his wife's suggestion, seeks out a physician, his primary care doctor, and is seeking a prescription for antidepressants. Missing his sister prompted him to do direct-to-consumer genetic testing to search for more family connections. He thought it might help. He received ancestry and health-related results, and he was surprised to learn that he has 97% chance that he has wet type earwax, that he is a 33% Caucasian European ancestry, that he has an increased risk for type 2 diabetes, that he has a CYP2D6 variant that's related to his rate of drug metabolism, how quickly he metabolizes drugs, how quickly they clear from his bloodstream into his urine, you know, as waste, how quickly he metabolizes. And then that he's a carrier for sickle cell disease. He's a carrier because he has only one copy of the variant. If he had two, he would actually have sickle cell disease. So some of this is surprising to him. So this is not a report. You could go to 23andMe and get a sample report of what their ancestry reporting and their traits and their health reports look like. But this is a list of some of the traits that you could learn about. You could learn about whether you're likely to have bunions, dandruff, earwax, what the likelihood of a particular eye color is, also ancestry composition, but also health-related information. And so although this is a little bit old and it may have expanded since then, they talk about type 2 diabetes, breast cancer-related mutations, not all of them, but some in particular, BRCA1 and 2, cholesterolemia, hereditary hemochromatosis, late onset Alzheimer's disease, for which there is a specific informed consent process because of the emotional and social impact of learning about your risk for Alzheimer's disease, and also because this is one of the conditions for which there is currently still relatively little to do to prevent onset or to affect the development of the condition. You can receive, as Mr. Gordon did, carrier status reports for over 40 different conditions, monogenic conditions, conditions for which one gene in particular has an overwhelming effect on whether one would develop the condition or not. And so as their advertising suggests, so let's look at Parkinson's disease, where it says here, they will report on two variants in two different genes that are relevant for people of European, Ashkenazi Jewish, and North African Berber descent. So what does that imply? It implies that we don't really know what those variants mean, or we don't know if they occur in someone who is not of that descent. It has not yet been well characterized. We don't understand the meaning. And the reason for that is that there's been extreme sampling bias in our genomic studies. Over 96%, maybe it's dropping a little, but we're still well above 90% of those who've been enrolled in genome-wide association studies, studies that characterize the meaning of different genes along the genome, have been from European descent. That means that for Asian Americans, African Americans, Africans, Asians, we don't really know what some of the genetic findings mean for them. Just hasn't really been studied adequately. So sampling matters. And that's one reason that President Obama launched the Precision Medicine Initiative that I talked about last time, which is now called the All of Us Research Program. It's the reason that he wanted to develop a research platform that would be the most diverse research platform for genomic research in the world, because in some sense, we are the most diverse population in terms of continental ancestry in the world. And by enrolling people from the full range of continental ancestries and enrolling them in sufficient numbers, we can do the epidemiological research to find out what a variation in a gene, a particular location on the genome, means for people in a particular population, where one way of characterizing or one cutting up the world into populations is based on continental ancestry. The reason that matters is that those genes travel with other genes from handed down through generations from the time one's forefathers were on a different continent, perhaps. And so genes have traveled together. And because genes along the genome, some can, we might say, cancel each other out or have influences of turning on or turning off a particular gene, what other genes exist along the genome with a particular variant that we think we understand, say, in a European ancestry population, what others are there in someone from an African continental ancestry, they matter. So having a population that is diverse so we can study those differences and find out which differences matter for human health is really important. We haven't to date, we globally have not done a good job of that. So in short, broad representation is needed in research studies because the interpretation of genetic variations depends on comparing a person's genome to a reference genome, and then interpreting the significance of the variants that are discovered, the variations, the differences between my genome and the reference genome. However, variants are not as well characterized. That is, their meaning is not as frequently and reliably established for members of underrepresented populations. Moreover, when investigators rely on self-reported continental ancestry, on forms we call race, there are likely negative implications for the scientific soundness of the studies, because the ways that individuals are grouped together determine the genetic frequencies that are attributed to those particular groups, to particular populations. And so if we group people together imprecisely, people who say, well, I'm Black, I'm Black, I'm Black, and in fact, continental ancestry, one person is 30% African descent, 70% African descent, 90% African descent. Well, that's imprecise. And those differences may make a difference in how frequently genes are found in the individuals in that study population. Garbage in, garbage out, imprecision in, imprecision out. So going back to Mr. Gordon, he was surprised by his 33% Caucasian or European ancestry. He described himself as being surprised because he's a proud Black man, and he's a healthy Black man, except for his depression. So he was surprised by several of the findings, but begins with this about the European ancestry. Now, this quotation is one that I found when I was traveling in India. May India have good fortune soon. And it was on the front page with this color photo of Mr. Khan, who was quoted as saying, "It hurts me when I think that my forefathers were from Israel." He's the 92-year-old patriarch of a family that's liberal by political temperament, but very pious by Islamic persuasion. He's bracing himself to face the result of his 28-year-old nephew's research into the Klan's ancestry that is suggesting that they descend from one of the Hebrew tribes of Israel. So in short, what the findings of his forefathers might be is really messing up this 92-year-old's understanding of his place in the world, in society, and perhaps to some extent with regard to his religion, his God. For Mr. Gordon, being 33% Caucasian European ancestry, as it's reported to him, might not actually be as surprising as all that, because most African Americans recognize that they are the product of, handed down, probably some degree of relationship with those of European ancestry between their African slave forefathers or foremothers and white slaveholders. So Sally Hemings is pictured here. What's the relevance of this besides psychological discomfort? Well, for example, we in this country have granted casino rights to members of Native American tribes, but did not have ancestry testing to determine how much Native American blood, heritage, genetic heritage, one might need to have to qualify for some of those profits. Or one could imagine a scholarship that's set aside for an Irish American, for Swedish American, for a Native American, for Pacific Islander students. Well, what percentage ancestry is relevant? I would in fact argue none of it is really relevant, or maybe only in a very small degree, because it's relevant for how those folks have been treated and how they have viewed themselves throughout their lives. And that is much more relevant to whether they are entitled to casino profits or a scholarship, but something to discuss. So that's the social side of Mr. Gordon's ancestry finding, but it also has relevance for his increased risk for type 2 diabetes, because that is better characterized, in people of European ancestry. And the fact that he has a third of his ancestry as European and that he's at increase for type 2 diabetes might give us more reason to be concerned about that diabetes-related finding than if he were only 5% European ancestry. But then again, his risk for type 2 diabetes is going to be much more influenced by his diet, exercise, environmental factors than his genes. Here's a quotation from a New England Journal article that attempts to or documents states some of the differences that I've been referring to. It says specifically the frequency and effect sizes of genetic variants associated with disease risk may vary across populations. We are finding that it does vary, but in particular cases, it may vary. We just don't know yet. Polygenic risk scores, which we'll talk about next time, derived from studies of populations with European ancestry have less predictive power when applied to non-European populations. For example, the polygenic risk score for breast cancer is about one-third as predictive for Black women as for women of European descent, a disparity with clear implications for the future of precision medicine. Has clear implications for health disparities between Black and white women in this country, because we have a tool that works much better for white women than for women of color. Now that CYP2D6 variant that's related to drug metabolism, well, that would be relevant for prescribing antidepressants to Mr. Gordon. To help ensure that he receives a therapeutic dose and avoids adverse drug reactions or side effects, before prescribing a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, an SSRI antidepressant, his physician should investigate the meaning of this variant. It also needs to consider the reliability of its interpretation in light of his continental ancestry. So quickly, pharmacogenomics seeks to identify those who will be at increased risk of adverse drug reactions, those who will be at increased risk of a lack of response, a lack of therapeutic response from a drug. So if one metabolizes drugs too rapidly, is an ultra-rapid metabolizer, there may be too little that remains in the system to be effective, to actually affect Mr. Gordon's mood. If he is a poor metabolizer, then he's going to retain more drug in his system. It may build up, he may get too much, and it leads to an adverse drug reaction. Now that's simplification, but is the basics theory of pharmacogenomics. And then there's the fact that Mr. Gordon was in one strange way surprised by his 97% chance of wet type earwax, because he already knew he had wet earwax. So that indicates the challenges of probabilistic reasoning. It's like waking up today to a prediction of an 89% chance of rain when it's pouring outside. So that leads people to have some question about, you know, what are these genomic results really telling me when they're saying I have a chance of, and I already do have a particular trait or condition. But also, and this loops back to incidental findings and takes us close to our end, the gene that's responsible for having wet or dry earwax, depending on which variant you have at that particular location, the gene location on your genome, is also responsible for the presence or absence of underarm odor associated with sweat. Once again, one probably knows whether those facts about one's sweat and one's earwax. But that phenomenon of pleiotropy, when one gene is associated with more than one trait, is a way that an incidental finding can arise. So a person might be enrolled in a study or be seeking information about risk for aortic aneurysm, and thus have testing for ApoE, that gene, the ApoE gene. But that's also associated with risk levels for Alzheimer's disease. So one could not have testing for this gene related to aortic aneurysm without also receiving information about likelihood of developing Alzheimer's disease. Some people may want to know about the risk of an aneurysm, but not want to know about their risk of becoming demented, having dementia, I should say, in later in life. So an incidental finding may be due to pleiotropy. This gene for earwax is an example of a single gene condition or trait. There are about 6,000 such conditions, diseases that we know about. And these are some examples of them. They're conditions that we hear about in the context of talking about genetics. Overall, most of them, most monogenetic conditions are fairly rare. These are some of the more prominent or more common ones. And certainly sickle cell disease and sickle cell trait is more common among those who are of African continental ancestry. Next time, we'll talk about we will not talk about monogenic conditions. We'll be talking about conditions that are in general a matter of genes and environment for their manifestation, those that we have predictive testing to characterize the level of risk that one has. We'll talk about polygenic risk scores like Mr. Gordon's diabetes risk. And so things will get more complicated. That's for next time. And at this time, I'll stop sharing my screen and instead share some conversation.
So I'll start, but encourage other people to join. Can you talk a little bit about risk? You talked about monogenic risk score, polygenic risk scores, and so forth. But I find that sort of wrapping your head around the idea of risk can be tricky, because sometimes when I hear risk, I think, oh, if I have this genetic characteristics, it's going to cause me to have la-da-da. But in fact, you had that quote from the New England Journal of Medicine article that said polygenic risk scores don't mean that much when they're constructed from one population and applied to another. And I'm supposing that might have to do with constructing a correlation that people assume is actually causative, but we don't really know.
That's right. And so the risk, the notion of risk is very complicated. So because in almost every case, having a change, a variation in a gene, where a gene is simply a location of interest along one's genome, having a change here that predisposes or increases one's risk for a particular disease does depend on other factors. So even those, and I think I might have used last time, the example of Huntington disease risk, where so far as we know, anyone who has the relevant variations at that location for the Huntington disease gene will go on in later life, mid to later life, to develop the neurological effects of Huntington disease, dementia, difficulty with motor skills, and so on. Life may intervene at the very least. I may go off to war and be shot before I ever develop that condition. I may be in an automobile accident. I may face a pandemic and become ill with COVID. So the environment in those very gross, big ways can intervene in socially mediated ways in some sense. But for other conditions, you know, for the breast cancer related genes here, BRCA1 and 2 at those locations, we don't know exactly what mediates and causes, well, causes breast cancer in some people with those variations and not in others. It does, having those variants does put a person in a population that as a whole has an 85% lifetime risk of developing breast cancer some point during the lifetime. But it's not 100%. Well, what's the difference? Well, genes, other genes, perhaps, environmental factors, dietary factors, whether or not one has had children, has been pregnant and given birth, whether or not one is male or female, because those genes can be found in men as well. But although we say the lifetime risk the same for men, we're not quite sure because there's a lower population of men to study. So we don't have as good figures, good statistics. So those additional factors all combined, and some of which are not going to be knowable and characterizable in the individual person, will affect the onset of disease or not. It will affect it definitely, but will either lead to or help to prevent disease. And the same is true of other tests like cholesterol level, like other predictive tests, like how many packs of cigarettes did you smoke in your youth? Well, some people could still be smoking a pack a day and never develop lung disease, and we don't yet really understand why that is. Whereas others obviously have an increased risk for lung cancer and other respiratory diseases. That's environmental. Yes, please, Mr. Dilley.
I'm trying to understand. It sounds like we haven't, this research isn't based on the entire genome. It's based on a portion of it. What do you have a sense of what portion we know well, what portion we barely know, you know, that kind of thing?
Now, I can come back next time with a better answer of kind of what percentage we know and don't, but there is the genome. The exome is the part that we think is of greatest importance, and that's, as you're saying, portions of the genome. We thought that the junk, and it was called junk DNA, didn't have any real importance. And now we're beginning to think, well, maybe some of that which we thought was junk is important because it mediates, it affects the way that the important genes function. And the most important thing for me, and maybe you all may be more scientifically astute than I was when I started out in this, the most important thing that I figured out was that a gene isn't so much a thing as a place on the genome, on the DNA, that is relevant, that is important. And we're discovering more and more genes all the time, and thus more and more of the genome is becoming recognized as being of importance. We hear that, you know, people have much more DNA that they share with each other than is different between us. So that's the other thing, that a whole lot of the genome is just what makes us the human structure that we are, not the specific whether my liver is predisposed to hemochromatosis. That's a little bit, but the fact that I've just got a liver that's part of that genome that, well, I hope we all have a liver that's the same across, you know, all people. So, you know, that's really important, but it's not important for disease risk. So once again, there's also the, you know, important for what question, and therefore there's a lot of values or interests, right? What are you interested in? What do you care about? Are you trying to sort people into Black people and white people? Or are you trying to figure out what causes a particular hereditary condition? That helps to determine, you know, what you think is important and should be known within the genome.
Thank you.
Yeah. And at this point, you know, if I were kind of at a blackboard, or if it was easier to move around among slides and I had them handy, you know, for talking about the genome, I would have the double helix, and that twists. And I would be showing that at each point on this double helix, there is the A and the T paired together and the C and the G paired together. These are different amino acids, and sometimes they get screwed up. And instead, where we should have an A and a T, we don't. And instead have the different amino acid, and that is the basis of the variation that at then a particular gene point, particular location or locus on the genome, that variation makes a difference that actually leads to my liver having a predisposition for, you know, retaining iron and having hemochromatosis that can ruin my liver.
So again, encourage folks to pop up with their questions. A lot of this, there's a lot of technical language in here that can be, where it's easy for me to feel stupid because, what is a genome? Well, it's just a place on a gene. Well, give me the street address for that place.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, the concepts, if we boil it down, can be very simple. And I don't think anybody should hesitate to ask for clarification on something that just isn't obvious. But while we wait for another question, I'll ask this, which you nibbled around the edges of a little bit, or you talked about sort of in various indirect and direct ways. I often get tisk-tisk by folks who tell me, to remind me that race and ethnicity are not biological constructs, that they are in fact social and cultural constructs, and we can get ourselves into a whole lot of trouble by confusing that fact. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
I will. Because you mentioned something about the language and all of that being technical and so on, I'll also offer one more kind of image that I find really helpful to think of. Even so, back in the day when I got into this, someone explained to me, and it may actually have been on a public broadcasting TV special, that if we think of our genome, as we have these chromosomes, we get one from mom, one from dad, and so on, and it goes into the, you know, that which becomes the embryo and, you know, the person. If we think of each of our chromosomes as being like a file cabinet that has various things filed together, right? Like, and in some cases, in each of those file cabinets, some things get misfiled, moved around in the wrong place. Well, that's what a mutation is like. They get misfiled, and thus, whatever the function of that file cabinet is, each of our chromosomes being one, it doesn't function the right way. Now, sometimes the misfiling doesn't matter because it's, you know, something that just doesn't really have any structural significance in the body, doesn't change how the body is built, doesn't interact with the environment to cause disease. But sometimes those misfilings do matter. It's also possible to think about the file cabinet and that some of what gets filed into the file cabinets is handed down, heredity, right, genes, over generations. And some things were different based on your continental ancestry as to what got put into the file cabinet at particular points in it. Like you've got the hanging files and what got stuck into particular hanging file locations. And so that helps to make for difference, discernible differences, meaning regularly findable differences in the file cabinets of people who came from the African continent versus those who came from, say, the Asian continent. Okay. So we can sort, if we just look at a particular file cabinet and look in particular places, we can say, ah, this file cabinet looks as though it's making up a person who got stuff handed down, but that began with the inputs that were available on the African continent versus the Asian continent. So that's the biological notion. But then race, yes, is a social notion that is used for so many different purposes. As we're finding, one of the ways it's used is to make some people feel superior to others, which is allegedly then for them very comforting. It allows, we know from our current discussions, all the reasons that race is such a persistent concept in our lives. We could also, I'm going to shift for a moment, think of mothers and fathers as being persistent concepts in our lives. But we also think of all of the one generation ahead of us people who mother us and look after us and who father us, who pass on wisdom and who nurture us. And you know, what did I say? The wisdom seems to get passed on, we think, from the fathers and the nurturing from mothers. Well, that's of course a social construct as well, that we kind of divide up the division of labor of raising children. Now that's all getting, you know, changed in our current social situation. But another way that it's being changed is, as I was talking about, we can have an egg donated by one woman that's gestated in another woman. And then the baby that is born is given to a third woman. So a genetic mother, a gestational mother, a social mother. And then we have to sort out who has responsibility for that child. What do the legal papers say about who has to, you know, pay for you know, food, clothing, and shelter? Well, not the egg donor, probably not the gestational mom, but the social mom. Similarly for, you know, the sperm donor or the social father, the person actually raising a child. But should that change? Should kids have access back, some claim on their egg donor or their sperm donor parent? Are they parents? Well, for purposes of no understanding my risk for particular conditions, they're really relevant as parents for being in my life. Well, that's a decision, you know, that we sort out as a family. So even those concepts that seem, you know, very biological, mother and father, they have, you know, social roles that are mapped onto them for purposes. And one can imagine in some cultures, right, although it's really hard in most cultures to think of doing away with women, we are talking about developing artificial wombs where one could just incubate an embryo onto babyhood, doing away with mothers. And then you could say, well, can this just be a society of fathers, parents raising, but they all being, you know, so-called male parents? Well, what's male, right? And then you go to current debates about transgender people and whether, you know, which sporting teams they can compete on. So all of those, there's some, you know, inkling of a biological differences there. I mean, I can look at someone and tell that they're different skin colors. I'm looking at my nose right now. I need to put some powder on it. It's really red today. But we can see those empirical things, but whether they make a difference or not, that's the social determination.
I've got a
long winded answer. Yeah. Mr. Hayes.
Lisa, this may be a ridiculous question, and I apologize, but is the genome absolutely separate from social, economic factors, like people who went through the Holocaust, has their genome been affected? What about slavery? The people that went through slavery, has their genome been affected by the stress that they experienced in their lives?
Right. Well, so, you know, I mean, the short answer, yes. We are, there's controversy, or there's a lot of interest in what's, you know, termed epigenetics. The environmental impact on the genome itself, and thus on the person, of things like the Irish potato famine, that's an example that's used, war, generations of racism, intense stress of any sort, that yes, that will in fact, you know, alter the biological environment, right? The physiological environment of the DNA, the physiological environment of sperm and ova, and the gestational environment of fetuses that are being incubated, gestated, right? And so, yes, that has an effect. We don't really understand it very well, but definitely has an effect. And certainly also has an effect, you know, right now on individuals. So that the stress of racism, we know, has an effect on you know, heart disease, respiratory conditions, you know, diabetes. And not just like, you know, the stress makes me eat a lot more and eat badly, and I seek out comfort food and I become obese, and that increases my risk for diabetes. Not only that way, mediated by my behavior, about which you could say, you really ought to make better choices, even though it's really hard, but also very directly through, you know, neurochemicals, that will affect risk for a range of conditions like diabetes and insulin production, heart disease, and respiration, and probably neurological conditions and later life dementia as well.
I have a concern. This is Joan Watson. Hi. And you've sparked a concern in me that I didn't know I had an hour ago. And that is, I see obviously the place for genetic testing and biological, medical health, public health research. Mm-hmm. I'm having a little bit of problem now with the purpose in light of the dangers of testing being available to the general public. And I'm wondering what advice you would give to a person or even a regulator of genetic testing today.
So for any test, I think it's very important to consider what a person's going to do with the results. What's the point? And I don't think any medical test should be undertaken for recreational purposes, which I think a lot of the genetic testing, you know, it's a scientific or medical test, is undertaken for, you know, out of curiosity. I'm opposed to that myself. You may have noticed. I also think, and next time we'll talk a little bit about a danger of genetic testing, is our fascination with the genetic side and thus our neglect of the environmental side. And our hope that, as I'll talk in the fourth talk, the hope has always been, well, we can get in there and we can change the genes and prevent conditions. Well, for most conditions we care about, we already know how to prevent them, and it's through environmental means. It's through behavior and diet and cleaner air and water and so on. Not for some, absolutely not, in terms of, you know, cystic fibrosis, that, you know, a whole bunch, those 6,000, you know, conditions, some of them very rare, you really would need to change genes or come up or use genetic information to find better treatments and prevention. But for a whole lot of things, we already know how to prevent ill health, and we don't. So I think genetics and genetic testing in research, as you started out saying, is really important for understanding and as a tool. I think it's not the best thing for individuals to undertake unless there's a real purpose for it to help guide some decision or some intervention. Mm-hmm. So thanks for that. It was a kind of nice wrap up question. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
So I'll just say this has been marvelous. Thank you so much. I'm going to conclude the recording and welcome anybody who's feeling shy.